Radio friends, it's the second day of the 29th Democratic National Convention. The National Broadcasting Company is greeting you again from the Chicago Stadium. This is Ben Grauer reporting from the NBC booth overlooking the scene of action as the big day begins. And a big day it certainly promises to be. Today's the day the Democrats in National Assembly will affirm their party's platform and will select as their candidate the officers for the country's highest position. The convention and the nation is known for days. Franklin D. Roosevelt will be returned again as their choice for President of the United States, but as the 1,176 delegates file into the red wooden seats of this giant auditorium right now, there's no clear majority of them who have decided, either by direction or their own decision, who the choice for Vice President is. The race is still wide open, with Senator Harry Truman and Senate Majority Leader Alban Barkley the leading contenders, and Vice President Henry Wallace still very much in the contest. Today's sessions promise much that's exciting and dramatic, and a certainty that from the busy floor of this convention hall will come decisions of great political importance. And again, NBC is ready to bring you the proceedings in highlight and in detail. Manning our microphones, placed strategically at vantage points throughout the stadium, are members of NBC's staff of commentators and observers. Right alongside me here in the booth is Robert St. John. Robert's been sticking particularly close to the vice presidential tussle, and we'll want a word from him in a moment. Down below us on the speaker's platform is the well-known dean of commentators, H.V. Kaltenborn. And on roving assignments on the convention floor are Richard Harkness, Morgan Beatty, and Don Fisher of NBC's staff. All of them equipped with portable shortwave transmitters, ready to bring you action and comment from the delegates right there in their seats. In any moment, the convention session will begin under the chairmanship of temporary chairman, Governor Robert Kerr of Oklahoma. And already the convention hall is fairly well filled. I'd say that about 50% of the delegates have taken their places, and we have, out of the some 20,000 seats available here in the Chicago Stadium, about 8,000 to 10,000 filled. There'll be more and more action as this session goes along, including the address by the permanent chairman, Senator Robert Jackson of Indiana, and the report of the Resolutions Committee on the platform from the Democratic National Committee for 1944. Tonight, the address will be delivered. Addresses will be delivered by Helen Gagan Douglas and by Quentin Reynolds, and the speech of acceptance is expected by the President of the United States following his nomination for President of the United States by the Democrats in convention here this evening. After that, it is expected in the program agenda as it is being worked out now that the highly crucial balloting for Vice President will take place. But that all lies strictly in the realm of conjecture, and to give you a little clairvoyant view into that, I'm going to ask Robert St. John alongside us to appraise the situation and the vice presidential possibilities as they stand now. Mr. St. John.
Thanks, Ben. First, let me tell you that a piece of strictly non-political news caused a great deal of excitement here in the convention this morning. That bulletin which came in from London that said that Adolf Hitler had been slightly burned and bruised and had received a light brain concussion, and that a number of his Army and Navy officers had been injured when an attempt with explosives was made on the life of the Führer. Nearly all the delegates had picked up that story by word of mouth or by radio before they got into the hall, and that was one of the things they were talking about. The other thing they were talking about was, of course, the vice presidential race. Yesterday afternoon, it looked as if Henry Wallace was losing ground. But this morning, he's hit the comeback trail. Kansas, with 16 convention votes, previously unpledged, has caucused and balloted unanimously in favor of the former Secretary of Agriculture, now Vice President of the United States. And then the North Dakota delegation, with 8 votes, caucused, and it also unanimously endorsed Henry Wallace. But on the other side, Senator Truman picked up some support when Postmaster General Frank Walker told reporters this morning, "I am for Truman." After all, Walker is a member of the cabinet. And then the Democratic National Committee treasurer from the state of California told us here this morning that he had presidential approval in telling his California delegation that Franklin D. Roosevelt is convinced Truman will cost him fewer votes than any other candidate for vice president. And now back to Ben Grauer.
At this moment, the temporary chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Governor Robert Kerr of Oklahoma, a big, giant-sized man, has stepped to the center of the platform to the speaker's rostrum, and we will have the national anthem. We take you to the speaker's platform.
Mona Van.
Of the national anthem by the delegates standing soberly at attention and led from the speaker's rostrum by Miss Mona Van of the Chicago Civic Opera Company. One of the interesting and colorful ceremonies attendant to these sessions of the Democratic National Convention is the lowering of the massive giant-sized Klieg lights when the anthem is sung, and as the ringing words of the Star Spangled Banner sound out over this giant hall, the crowd is hushed, stands quietly, thoughtfully, and ranged along the mezzanines and balconies of the auditorium is a series of some 56 red, white, and blue neon lights. They're hardly noticeable. Her attention isn't attracted to them while the full lights are on. But when the Kliegs go down, the voices ring out, and the hush descends upon the auditorium, those prophetic V for Victory lights are plainly to be seen. Spotlighted high in the stratospheric ceiling of the Chicago Stadium is a giant American flag. I'd say it's about 60 by 40 feet. And a brilliant white spotlight picks that up alongside the band, which is up there in the rafters, the American Legion Band, which accompanies these renditions of the national anthem. And now a quick glance around the convention floor shows us that it's filling up fairly rapidly. The two center sections are practically completely filled. I see a number of vacancies in several state delegations, but others are almost complete. Looking over at the Texas delegation, which was the scene of much excitement and interest last night, comparative, in fact, actual calm is reigning. The regulars who have been seated by the Democratic Committee and whose credentials will be passed upon, and undoubtedly without any disturbance by the committee and credentials in just a few moments, fell into some sort of discussion with the representatives of the Rump Texas delegation, who were parading with signs saying clean house in Texas and so on. This all occurred during a spontaneous demonstration of party fidelity evoked by the ringing words of Governor Kerr in his keynote speech last night as he signalized the magnificent military exploits of the armed forces under the commander-in-chiefship of President Roosevelt. That gave us one of the most exciting and thrilling of the demonstrations we've had spontaneously touched off here on the Chicago Stadium floor. Much more is expected. There are promises to come along in the ensuing moments. This is today, Following the address by Permanent Chairman Jackson of Indiana, we will go into the business of roll call for presidential nominations, which will bring us the first presidential nominating speeches and the roll call, and then on to the actual balloting. Down on the platform, alongside Governor Kerr of Oklahoma, who is at this moment conducting some of the routine proceedings in connection with the convention, is H.B. Kaltenborn, and in this pause in the actual proceedings, I'm going to call on him for some observations.
I should like to say just a word about the attempt on Hitler's life. It runs on a par with previous attempts in that it was not directed against Hitler alone, but against the clique immediately surrounding Hitler. You will remember that when Hitler had his reunion in the famous beer hall in Munich, there was a previous attempt upon his life. That, too, was not directed alone against Hitler, but against the men who are in immediate contact with him. The reason for that is this. This attempt is undoubtedly inspired by a group in the Nazi Party that feels that things are going badly, that the clique now in control must be removed before they can go better. It is the first indication of that split in the internal unity of Germany, which presages division, revolt, and ultimate defeat. It is the sort of thing that's going to run on parallel now with the defeats at the front, and we can expect more of it. That is the significance. It is not that it is simply an attempt to assassinate Hitler. It is an indication of division in high German councils and the attempt to get something out of the way in order that something else may come into control. Just a word on the vice presidential situation. It seems to me, as the thing lines up, that it's going to be extremely difficult for Wallace to overcome the situation as it stands now. After all, there are four states that hold the vice presidential key. They are New York, where boss Edward J. Flynn is in favor of the senator, Senator Truman. There is the state of Illinois, where Mayor Kelly is in favor of Senator Truman. There is the state of New Jersey, where Boss Haig is in favor of Senator Truman. There is the state of Missouri, where Chairman Hennigan, as you heard him say over this microphone at the close of last night's session, he is in favor of Senator Truman. Now, this morning you heard from Robert St. John that Postmaster Walker is in favor of Senator Truman. You heard the statement from the treasurer of the Democratic Committee that President Roosevelt has advised him that Senator Truman would cost him fewer votes than anyone else in the position of vice president. We'll add that all together, and it seems to me that since this is a Roosevelt convention, the votes cannot go in any other way except to Senator Truman. Now back to the NBC booth.
Back in the booth, and while H.B. Kaltenborn has been talking to you from the speaker's platform, we've had word flashed up to us from the convention floor. One of our observers has gone over to the Iowa delegation, and we've found that, as yet, Vice President Henry Wallace, who is chairman of that delegation, incidentally, and who is here as a delegate to the convention, Vice President Wallace has not yet arrived and is not seated in the delegation as yet. The appearance of Mr. Wallace yesterday at last night's session, some 10 minutes before the session actually began, was the sign of somewhat of a demonstration, or at least a warm greeting from many members of the convention here assembled. The Iowa delegation was a focus of interest, and many delegates left their state and moved over to have a word with Vice President Wallace to say hello and so on. Somewhere on this floor, I can't pick him out now, but we'll have him on the air in just a moment, is one of NBC staff commentators, Richard Harkness, with a portable shortwave transmitter. Come in, Richard Harkness, will you, and tell us where you are.
And this is Richard Harkness on the floor of the convention. I am standing here right within arm's reach of the Iowa delegation in the middle aisle, away from the platform, here on the floor. Vice President Wallace has not arrived at convention hall this morning as yet. The word here is that he is conferring with some of his supporters and leaders in his hotel room downtown. There is an unusually heavy attendance here on the convention floor this morning for a morning session. Usually the delegates don't like to get up quite this early and come out to what promises to be only another speech. However, they have turned out in force this morning. I think that can be explained by the fact that there is an air of tenseness and an air of excitement here on the convention floor this morning. They got off to a good rip-roaring start last night, as you heard and read in your morning papers. And this morning, that same excitement has carried over. Here on the floor, the delegates are talking and speculating largely about Mr. Roosevelt's acceptance speech. They are wondering not only what he will say about platforms and issues this year and what he'll say about the war, they're also very interested in what he may say about his choice for vice president, his running mate on the 1944 National Democratic ticket. Mayor Kelly of Chicago, the Democratic chieftain here, has thrown Illinois to Senator Truman. The word is that Edwin Pauley of California, that the Californians may support Senator Truman too, and support them because, as they say, President Roosevelt thinks that Senator Truman would cost the Democratic ticket less votes than would Vice President Wallace if he were running again. The word here, too, is that possibly there may be a hot fight over the party platform this afternoon, a little later in this session. The word from the Stevens Hotel, where the platform committee is meeting, is that there is an argument over the racial equality plank to the platform. The one word is that the platform may promise equality of voting for white and Negro citizens. If that is true, there may be a revolt from the South, especially from the states of Texas, South Carolina, and Mississippi. This is Richard Harkness returning you to the NBC booth.
Back again in the booth, the convention floor scene is picking up a little as we come close to the major business of this morning's session, the address by the permanent chairman, Senator Sam Jackson of Indiana. Meanwhile, temporary chairman Kerr is carrying on these routine proceedings and introducing various distinguished guests. I spotted Attorney General Francis Biddle, who's left the Pennsylvania delegation for a moment to come up here on the speaker's platform, chatting with high officials of the Democratic National Committee. There is George Allen, former district commissioner of the District of Columbia. And I see Senator Jackson, too, has made his appearance and is waiting to be introduced. Madam Perkins, Secretary of Labor Francis Perkins, is here with another variation of a familiar three-cornered hat. And the scene is moving along with the excitement and brilliance that we eventually get here in these sessions of the convention, of the National Convention. Looking up on the walls of the convention hall, there are no signs except just one large strip of photographs marked Democratic presidents running from Jefferson through Jackson, Tyler, Polk, Cleveland, Wilson, up to Roosevelt. I see former Senator Minton of Indiana has just come onto the platform, and there's a bit of excitement from the newsreel photographic boys. They're flicking the shutters and flashing the bulbs, as they always do. There's good spirit, bon ami, here at this Democratic National Convention. The delegates are in particularly good mood. We haven't had the blistering heat we had 3 weeks ago at the Republican convention. In fact, everyone seems to be in pretty good humor, except I noticed the pretty young ladies who are selling war bond boutonnieres for a dollar each, and they haven't been selling them as happily or as rapidly as they'd want to. So I bought one, a lot of us did. Down on the speaker's platform, again, is a word of interest for you. We take you then to the speaker's platform.
Thank you very much.
We've returned to the booth for just a moment to introduce the next speaker, the permanent chairman of the Democratic National Convention, Senator Samuel Jackson of Indiana. Senator Jackson is raising the giant-sized gavel and pounding it. He's posing for just a moment for the photographers. He says, that's enough, boys, but they want one, two, three, five more. And here is Chairman Jackson with his official speech as opening his tenureship of the office of permanent chairman of the Democratic National Convention. The organ plays, the lights are shining. Some of the delegates have taken off their coats because it has warmed up a little bit here under the Klieg lights and the excitement and the press of the crowd. And in a moment, we'll have Senator Jackson.
Delegates,
to the Democratic National Convention and my fellow Americans. I am profoundly grateful for the high honor with which you invest me as permanent chairman of this great assembly. My appreciation of this post, great as it is, pales before the responsibility which I share with every other delegate in this convention. No convention since the birth of the Republic has had such grave significance. We meet to submit the future of America to the patriotic people of our nation for their decision. Their decision may determine the course of civilization itself. We are about to make a declaration of principles and present the candidacy of a man to guide our destinies for the next 4 years. We meet in the faith that this man, when elected, can and will continue to carry forward without interruption the tremendous burden of the war. We meet in the firm belief that mankind is not doomed to a perpetual fear, that each generation must send its millions to meet death in order to preserve liberty. We meet in the confidence that the man this convention selects for president will direct our men at arms to the speediest possible victory. He will help write the terms of an abiding peace. We meet with the conviction that that peace will be established by men who know the forces involved, not by uninformed, inexperienced, or irresponsible politicians. There may have been previous election years, in which it was not of overwhelming importance as to which of the two national parties selected the President of the United States. We have, on a few occasions in the past, muddled through with commonplace and less than commonplace presidents. While they have created scandal, delayed progress, or wrought economic havoc, a dozen years or so of painstaking labor erased resultant damage, corrected errors, and placed the nation again upon our appointed way. But this is not 1920. It is not 1924. Not 1928. This is fateful 1944. A change in national administration in time of war, even when surrounded by promising circumstances, is frightening to contemplate. It is dangerous to make. If it were true that the Republican nominee is as able, as experienced, as definite in his indicated principles of government, and as clear in his war and peace concepts as the present occupant of the White House, still, exchange now might well prove to be the tragedy of this generation. In terms of statesmanship, a comparison of the apparent dimensions of the GOP aspirant with a man of the stature of the president rules out of the field of rational consideration this proposed substitution for the party of Franklin D. Roosevelt. We are in the midst of the fiercest, most devastating war mankind has ever known. America cannot afford to take a chance. Our people will not gamble with the lives of their sons, your sons, and mine. Some there are who would have us believe that we and our noble allies already have our enemies vanquished, their morale shattered, and their power destroyed. But our military authorities tell us that is not true. These authorities say that tremendous battles loom large between us and the ultimate surrender of enemy arms, or even the destruction of enemy morale. America will win this war finally and completely, no matter who is elected President of the United States next November. But how many battleships would a Democrat defeat be worth to Hirohito? How many Nazi legions would it be worth to Adolf Hitler? Frankly, could Goebbels do better himself to bolster Axis morale than the word that the American people had upset this administration, the administration that made it possible for the Russians to drive the Nazis back to the Prussian border? We must not allow the American ballot box to be made Hitler's secret weapon. Under the most favorable circumstances, an administrative change, we know from experience, would mean change all the way down the official line. Change means interruption. Interruption means delay. Every day of delay means the sacrifice of more American lives. It means more telegrams reading, "We, the Adjutant General, regrets to inform you." Yes. Every day costs the lives of more American boys. The American electorate will not vote for change, interruption, and delay. To counteract the disadvantage of having such an unusually young and unpracticed candidate for the presidency, his supporters are endeavoring to make an asset of a liability. His nominator stressed the point. They, the American people, want youth instead of decadence. That last word, decadence, is an indecent slander if intended for the president. Roosevelt is in his full vigor and in the flower of his energy. He has more rugged vitality in him today than any two men the opposition has to offer. Franklin D. Roosevelt is the most valuable public servant in the world today. Governor Dewey was not nominated because of his youth, as they say, but in spite of it. He was selected because he was the governor of New York. His selection was not motivated by any abstract purpose of having youth serve America. He was picked in the hope that the 47 electoral votes of New York State would carry the old guard back into the White House. In precluding ourselves from the services of any man who in some great emergency shall be deemed universally most capable of serving the public. That great emergency is with us now. Our adversaries go back to their overworked watchword of many campaigns, that only Republicans are capable of dealing with the domestic problems of federal administration. Well, we know from bitter experience where their expertness in that field led us. After 3 uninterrupted terms in charge of the government, that expertness led us into the depths of depression. President Hoover had no slide rule with which to find his way out of that disastrous quagmire. The country turned from the great engineer to a Democrat. The country will not turn back from that Democrat to the pupil of the great engineer. Need we recite the swift method by which Roosevelt, from that day of his inauguration, stemmed the calamitous tide and started us toward economic security and adequate defense? But the old guard simply wails, "How long shall we keep the Democratic Party in Washington? How long? Until the escutcheons of this government shall have been cleansed of the debauchery of the Harding regime." How long? Until the economic and financial structures of this republic shall have been healed of and protected against the return of the rampant and unchecked piracy during the do-nothing administration of Calvin Cooley. How long? Until the farmer, businessman, and worker shall have been insured against a recurrence of the devastation wrought by the unfortunate and unsung administration of Mr. Hoover. How long? Until that permanent peace promised to the heroes of the First World War shall have been kept in spirit and in truth. How long? Until all these high ends shall have been reached, or until the people shall have lost faith in their accomplishment, for there is not a mustard seed of hope for their achievement in the promises made in this stadium last month by the party of Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. We are confident of victory at the polls. Our confidence springs from appreciation of what a Democratic administration, through years of stress, has done for our country. This confidence springs from the sentiment of the business world when it contemplates its sound, usual, peacetime prosperity. This confidence springs from the farmer who remembers the starvation prices he got for his product until the futile, feeble, faltering Republican regime gave way to the courageous, definite, and far-sighted Roosevelt policy. It is deepened by the comparison the farmer makes of these prices with the prices of his grain and livestock today. This confidence springs from the worker who finds himself for the first time in history guarded against the exactions of conscienceless exploitation. We have a right to be confident. But let us not be overconfident. For by that sin, off-year elections have been lost. Because Democratic voters have considered victory won, they have neglected to do their full share. We shall leave this convention hall touched with the livid fire of conviction that we will win because we deserve to win. We shall not only ensure against a disastrous overconfidence, but we shall make our victory so total that the hungry opposition will realize that their attempt to turn back the clock to the days of privilege and pillage is absolutely vain and will continue to be absolutely vain. Just 45 days ago, the greatest military expedition of all time crossed the choppy waters of the English Channel and landed on the beaches of Normandy. There was launched the genius, the sacrifice, and 3.5 years of the toil of our people. That flotilla of 4,000 ships and 11,000 aircraft carried the best trained and the best soldiers we have ever sent to war. They are our boys. Our hearts, our tears, our prayers, and our hopes are all with them. Mourning and sorrow are the lot of many today who have already lost their beloved on the field of battle. Multitudes more will be numbered among the bereaved as death stalks the way to liberation. How many more, or who else shall fall, no one knows. But while we await the outcome of their complete endeavor, in the name of heaven, now in the midst of their rendezvous with destiny, let us not take from them their commander-in-chief.
We have returned to the NBC booth overlooking the speaker's rostrum at the conclusion of this 35 to 40 minute address by the permanent chairman of the convention, Senator Sam Jackson of Indiana. The senator, a slight figure in a cool white suit or some wear, is receiving congratulations from Governor Kerr and from other officials here on the platform. And we're having some sort of a mild demonstration on the convention floor, waving of arms and throwing up of programs by the delegates
and they are warmly applauding the address just concluded of Senator Jackson. In fact, the senator has just returned to the rostrum to acknowledge the applause, and he's bowing and smiling to them. The orchestra and the band have struck up a tune. Two or three of the state banners have been taken from their posts at the corner of the delegation and are being waved in the air by the delegates. And we have a mild enthusiasm being displayed here on the floor. This whole session this morning has been marked by moderate enthusiasm, by no means equaling the excitement and tension we had last night, and perhaps also being due to the large number of entertainments and parties which were given by various officials throughout Chicago last night after the convention. In fact, one of the highlights of the post-session proceedings last night was the party, a large buffet and reception given by the genial host of the convention, Mayor Ed Kelly of Chicago. Myself and a large number of NBCites attended and found the mayor's hospitality flow warmly and expansively. And that may account for a general air of sedateness which pervades the hall. Let that be by no means a gauge of what will ensue in the next hour or so, because the room is filled with smoke-filled rumors. In fact, there are all kinds of tensions and whisperings and suggestions scurrying throughout the hall. The vice presidential situation is still extremely up in the air, and the candidacy or the possibility of being nominated of both Senator Truman and of Vice President Wallace is still entirely possible. And Senator Barkley, by the way, we have just been informed, who is another of the leading contenders for the vice presidential position, did take his place in the Kentucky delegation some moments ago. He has, however, left the Kentucky delegation and gone down under the platform to change his suit, we're told, to prepare for his appearance before the convention, when he will have the honor, which was his 4 years ago, of placing the name of President Roosevelt in nomination for the presidency again. He probably will be wearing another of those white summer suits which he wore 4 years ago in Chicago when he placed the name of President Roosevelt before the convention at that time. Senator Barkley is a leading contender, as we say, for the vice presidential candidacy on the Kentucky delegation. Looking over to the middle aisle, we see a veritable jam of delegates and I think members of the press, too, and officials who are going to the New York delegation and to the Missouri delegation, which is the headquarters of information about Senator Truman. And over in the New York delegation, I see the tall, broad-shouldered figure and the bald pate and smiling countenance of Jim Farley. Jim Farley is taking his place in the New York delegation. He's surrounded by reporters. He, I presume, has no comment to make at this time. Similarly, when we quizzed Senator Barkley a moment ago whether he would make any statement, he said, "I'll have no comment. My next comment will be the placing of the name of President Roosevelt in nomination." All this scene is changing rapidly with these rumors and suggestions and possibilities developing and subsiding for a moment. And now I see that the applause at the conclusion of Senator Jackson's speech has subsided. The delegates are taking their places. The sergeant-at-arms are now trying to clear that very important center aisle where so much of the news and information flows. Right alongside there on the speaker's platform is H.V. Kaltenborn, and we'll switch down to Mr. Kaltenborn right now.
I've just had a bulletin handed me which states that James A. Farley, the man who fought a third-term nomination for President Roosevelt, plans to protest against a fourth by voting for Senator Harry F. Byrd of Virginia. I've also just received a report on the caucus of the Tennessee delegation, which concerns the platform. The Tennessee delegation voted against approval of the race and religious platform plank. That plank was read to the delegation by Senator McKellar. It calls for the right of all races, religions, and creeds to live and vote equally with all other citizens. That is one of the most liberal racial planks that has ever been brought before a Democratic convention. The Tennessee delegation caucused on it and decided to vote against it. It is my understanding that it is definitely incorporated in the platform, as that platform will be reported here today, and consequently, there will be some kind of a fight on the floor against that particular clause of the platform unless by some last-minute compromise it is removed or changed. Back to the NBC booth.
Right now on the speaker's rostrum, routine business of the convention is proceeding before the next important highlight, the report on the Committee of Credentials, and following that, the report on the Committee on Platform and Resolutions. That will be the platform report of which Mr. Kaltenborn has spoken a moment ago. It's not clear at this moment whether the platform will be ready in time. It's being mimeographed right now, and whether it'll be ready to be presented to the convention, it's entirely possible that the nominating speech of Senator Barkley will be given before the platform committee report is presented. However, predating that, there's a possibility of some interest and excitement developing when the Committee on Credentials makes its report with the very moot seating of the Texas delegation. That flamed into action last night with what approached the possibility of a bit of fisticuffs over there in the Texas delegation as Dan Mooney, the former governor of Texas, who had the Texas regulars who were seated, exchanged words and opinions with those who were presenting the banners asking for the removal of this regularly seated delegation. Those banners, incidentally, bore signs, Clean House in Texas, We in Texas Want Roosevelt, and one particularly which roused the ire of the regulars seated here in the convention was Sweep the Judases Out of Texas. And I understand that there was much excitement and tension going on down there, and as we watched it here on the floor, a possibility of an open fight, but it did not develop. However, a parliamentary tussle is in the offing and probably will develop when that report of the Committee of Credentials is presented to the convention. Alongside us is Bob St. John, who's been running through the latest bulletins as they develop and has some comments to make at this moment. Bob.
Thanks, Ben Grauer. Here are some last-minute developments. Senator Guy Gillette of Iowa, who has stayed away from this convention because of his opposition to a fourth term for President Roosevelt, has just telegraphed an offer to help Vice President Henry Wallace in his campaign. His telegram read, "Am ready to help anywhere I am needed." Wallace has remained in his hotel rooms all the morning, doing smoke-filled conference room business, receiving callers, lining up votes. His campaign manager has just let the word creep out that they are ready at any time for the vote on the vice presidency. That would seem to indicate great confidence. They claim they have 400 votes lined up already. Of course, that isn't enough for the nomination, but it's more than anyone else has. The governor of Georgia was one of the callers on Vice President Wallace this morning, and he said that unless President Roosevelt tells the convention in writing that he's changed his mind and no longer wants Wallace as his running mate, he and the Wallace forces assume the vice president still has Mr. Roosevelt's blessing, and they're going to stick with him. Now, the Illinois delegation is caucused, and 58 votes they have. They voted to go for Senator Lucas of Illinois for vice president until they're released by somebody else. Now let's see if there aren't some other... Oh, here is an announcement that Senator Harry F. Byrd of Virginia will be placed in nomination for the presidency later today by Mrs. Fred Nooney of Jacksonville, Florida. And we've been told that James A. Farley is going to cast his vote for that candidate, for Senator Byrd, rather than for President Roosevelt, with whom he broke. And here's another little item that says that Senator Eastland has predicted that Mississippi's votes for the vice presidency will be switched to Truman whenever it becomes apparent that their favorite son, Sam Jones, cannot win the vice presidency. And now I switch you back to Ben Grauer.
While Bob St. John's been talking, Chairman Jackson has introduced several distinguished guests. Just a moment ago, he called up from the platform onto the rostrum the lion of publicity and public relations of the Democratic National Committee, the Venerable Charles Michelson, the tall, gaunt, gray-haired figure in glasses and studious face. And he, Charlie Michelson, walked to the center, or to the rostrum, rather, and took a very warm round of applause from the audience here. The next, just a moment ago,
Their resolution of thanks to Governor Kerr of Oklahoma for his tenure of office as temporary chairman was introduced by the Honorable Lon Duckworth of Georgia, and the report of the Committee on Rules and Order of Business is going forward now. Strictly routine proceedings, sort of parliamentary moving back and forth, which will be accomplished in a few moments, and the next two important orders of business will then come up on the platform. They are the report of the Committee on Credentials involving the contested seating of the Texas delegation and the possibility of there being a fight on that report, and then the report of the Committee on Platform and Resolutions, which will be delivered by the Honorable John McCormick of Massachusetts, Majority Leader of the House of Representatives. There is a little excitement now in the Oklahoma delegation. The Oklahoma delegation is cheering songs from the show of the same name, which made the name of the state of Oklahoma a worldwide and world-loved. It was what a beautiful morning for Governor Kerr himself yesterday in his keynote speech, when he was so warmly received by the convention audience, and when they tipped off a tremendous demonstration as he spoke of the vitality and spirit of Roosevelt's leadership in the armed forces of the United States. The convention auditorium itself has been filling up. We had only about 8,000 people here out of the some 20,000 seats available, but now there's a goodly number of them sifting into their chairs, visitors and guests, and most of the boxes are filled directly opposite us on the north side of the stadium, and also the row after row of press seats, hard, straight, pine seats, serviceable and utilitarian, they're filling up too. Incidentally, those seats were here for the Republican National Convention, some 200,000 feet of priority lumber, which Andy Frain and the other gentlemen who take charge of arrangements here in the convention hall saw to it stayed right in their place. Down on the platform, H.B. Kaltenborn's been listening to Senator Jackson, been making some notes on the address which the permanent chairman just gave, and we'd like to have Mr. Kaltenborn's comments at this time.
Well, there's a very interesting contrast between the fire and brimstone speech of Governor Kerr last night and the much more quiet talk that the Honorable Samuel D. Jackson gave us today. Jackson is no rabble-rouser like Governor Kerr. His delivery is much more quiet, and in particular, there is no aptness in his phrasing. There were no epigrams. There were no alliterative phrases such as cooling with Coolidge and hardening with Harding and hungering with Hoover that caught the fancy of the convention last night. He did not bring the convention to its feet, and at the close, the applause was not particularly spontaneous, although there was a friendly response, and one by one the various delegations rose to their feet. The inability of a speaker in this tremendous auditorium to point up his phrases and to deliver them with a tremendous bang is the thing that sometimes fails to let even an excellent speech get over with any particular effect. It was a straightforward, workmanlike job, but a political speech without highlights. And here, highlights are needed to rouse the interest of the delegations. I should say that at least half of them paid comparatively little attention. Well, as I went through the speech and tried to pick out the high points, I found that there were comparatively few. For example, the first point was that democratic defeat is a victory for Japan and Germany. Then he went on to tell us that Dewey was inexperienced. Said that the Republican senators were those who balked Wilson's peace efforts. Well, they weren't all Republicans. Said that the GOP opposed all constructive steps. Then quoted Washington in favor of the fourth term. Well, it would be easy to quote half a dozen Democratic platforms which made declarations against even a second term. He contrasted Hoover's mistakes with Roosevelt's achievements. And then finally warned against overconfidence. That was a good point, because as matters stand today, it's impossible for either party to be absolutely sure that it's going to win in November. Now back to the NBC booth.
While H.P. Kaltenborn's been talking, the band's been playing selected state airs, and each state has stood up as its state song was played and bowed to the audience. We just had a song from Georgia. Right now, deep in the heart of Texas is ringing out over the convention floor, and the large Texas delegation has stood up in place and waving the Texas banner. Looking over towards the Texas delegation, I see Richard Harkness, NBC's analyst, right down there on the convention floor with a shortwave transmitter. So we'll switch down to you now, Mr. Harkness.
And this is Richard Harkness on the convention floor, and I am literally in the heart of Texas down here. I'm right in the middle of the Texas delegation. They're staging a little demonstration of their own, which was touched off when the band and organ played the tune Deep in the Heart of Texas. This convention started off in a rather dull mood this morning. It is a little tough diet to have an hour or almost an hour of political oratory right after your breakfast. But now the convention is getting het up, as you might say, and anything may happen. These Texans are waiting here in a rather belligerent mood. They don't want any trouble, but if there is trouble, they'll have some of it for the Credentials Committee to bring in its report. As its report should be in shortly, I return you now to the NBC booth.
We've been telling you that we're not too sure just what the next order of business will be, whether it will be the committee reports or the nominating speech for by Senator Barkley. Best idea in the world would be to go to the head man, and the head man right now is seated at an NBC microphone, the permanent chairman of this convention, Senator Sam Jackson of Indiana. So we're going to switch down to the platform and to Senator Jackson.
Go ahead, Senator Jackson. I've just had the privilege of telling the radio audience what a workmanlike speech you delivered over these microphones. Now, here you are to speak for yourself directly to the NBC audience. I wish you'd tell us a little something about the proceedings for the rest of today.
Well, Mr. Kaltenborn, first let me thank you for a very fine compliment, not only because of what you've said, but because of its author. I appreciate that. Now, as to today, Mr. Kaltenborn, we're waiting now on two chairmen of two committees. They're not entirely routine matters either. One of them is a report on the rules and order of business, which might bring up the two-thirds rule effort to substitute two-thirds rule for the majority rule on nominations. And then the other is the platform, and they're not here yet. The chances are they're in a hotel room right this minute giving the finishing touches to the text. And we hope it'll be here in a few minutes. Meanwhile, I'm surprised if these people can hear anything we say on account of the way Dixie has taken over the entire convention hall. But to get back to what you asked me, as soon as those items of business are out of the way, there will be the nomination for the President of the United States. If that concludes at a reasonable late hour this afternoon, there will be a recess until about 8:30 tonight. And then tonight, after the President accepts the nomination, as we understand he is to do, we will go into the nomination for Vice President. And then we'll grind at that until parliamentary situations change the course of events or until we finish.
Do you think that you're going to be able to finish tonight sometime?
Well, if you'll give me a little slice of tomorrow morning and call it tonight, I'll say yes.
Good. Everybody, I think, who's on the working end of the convention likes the idea of going through with the night session and winding her up instead of coming back for another day. But I'm told that our good host, Mayor Kelly, would rather have us stay here for another day.
We won't get into the motives, but I will agree with your implication that staying late at night puts a sort of a cap, Chief, on the dramatics of the situation.
Quite right. Let me ask you this question about procedure. I've just had word from the Tennessee delegation that they are going to fight against one of the planks, as is their privilege under Democratic procedure.
Course. That's right.
Now, what happens when a delegation opposes one particular plank?
Well,
how is that worked out?
As a matter of fact, technically, they present the entire platform except the one to which they object and insert the one which is their plank of their choice. And then the question goes before the delegation as to the substitution of a minority report for the majority report. Well, now, in actuality, it's merely a form of accomplishing an amendment to a report and is handled in about the same way.
Oh, yes. So that is not the thing that's going to take a particularly long time.
Well, it depends upon the heat of the debate. And,
yeah.
And how stiff
what are
contest...
the rules on that debate? Do you have a certain limit on speeches from the floor?
Not a certain limit as to 30 minutes on each speech, but no limit as to the number of speeches. If this convention wanted to favor Mr. Kelly and his folks, they could stay here and talk themselves all next week, so far as our rules are concerned.
I see.
But they probably won't.
No. One final question. The two-thirds rule. We understand that some of the southern delegations are trying to reinstate that, but we've had no word that there's going to be a fight on that on the floor. Now, is this delay in the report of that committee, which is rather unusual because that usually comes through fairly promptly, does that have something to do with this two-thirds rule?
I don't relate the one, this incident to that the situation at all. I don't think they have any connection.
No. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for calling me to the microphone, Mr. Kallenborn.
That was
back in the booth now after this conversation between H.V. Kaltenborn of the NBC staff and Senator Sam Jackson, the chairman of the Democratic National Convention. While these two gentlemen have been talking, the orchestra has been playing various tunes, including Dixie. You may have heard it in the background there, and as Dixie's familiar strains sounded out under these cavernous walls and ceiling of the giant auditorium, the Chicago Stadium, a large part of the delegates stood up, and all of the representatives of the various southern states, Kentucky, North and South Carolina, Florida, Virginia, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, yes, Georgia, of course, and Texas, and even Oklahoma, they all stood up and waved their state banners with the familiar strains of Dixie. Right now, we're in a pause between the proceedings here at the Democratic National Convention. We have spotted and highlighted the various vantage points where action and excitement and important political developments may take place. Morgan Beatty with a shortwave transmitter is over at the Iowa delegation watching the Vice President Wallace situation. Don Fisher stationed near Missouri's delegation in the event that anything develops on the candidacy of Senator Harry Truman. Right now, California has raised up a great state standard. California state banner with the brown bear in the center and trimmed with scarlet. A fine, handsome silk standard, and they're waving it lustily and happily. While this little lull in the proceedings is going on and the delegates are having a bit of fun and frolic, we're going to pause in our broadcast here from the NBC booth in Chicago Stadium. We'll pause for station identification.
This is Chicago WMAQ.